With its very last bit of momentum, the arrow shifted onto Atlas. The game console immediately cast a privacy cone where they sat, refracting the light to hide them from the rest of the room and deflecting all sound waves. Beyond the shimmering wall of photons, which rippled and bent like the surface of water in a pond, Avery could see the others, though they couldn't see her. They were shouting and waving at the gaming console, probably trying to reset the game and make her spin again. Nothing fun about having siblings together in the cone, right?
"You okay?"
Atlas asked quietly. He had a half-full bottle of Atomic in his hand and tried to pass it to her, but she shook her head. She was already confused, and the alcohol was stirring up her feelings for Atlas in a dangerous way. "I've never kissed anyone before. I'm going to be terrible at it," she blurted out and cringed. What had made her say that? Atlas took a long pull of the Atomic, then set it down carefully. To his credit, he didn't laugh. "Don't worry," he finally said. "I'm sure you'll be a great kisser."
"I don't even know what to do!"
Outside the cone, Avery saw Tracy Ellison, who had a huge crush on Atlas, gesturing angrily.
"You just need practice."
Atlas smiled and shrugged.
"Sorry it's me in here instead of Brecken."
"Are you kidding? I'd rather..."
Avery halted. She couldn't let herself finish that sentence. Atlas looked at her curiously, his brow furrowed in an expression she couldn't quite read.
"Aves?" he said, but it came out more like a question.
He leaned closer. Avery held her breath. The invisibility cone dissolved, letting reality back in. Avery had never been sure whether that almost kiss was real or whether she'd just imagined it. As the memory washed over her now, she looked at Atlas, who glanced up, seeming to feel her gaze. But if he was thinking of that night, too, he didn't give any indication. He just studied her for a moment, then seemed to come to a decision.
"I'm out this round," he said, disengaging from the game and walking over to where she stood. "Hey."
He gently pulled the drinks from her hands and set them on a table. Avery had forgotten she was holding them. She tripped forward a little.
"Want me to take you home?"
Atlas reached out to steady her. It was just like always, Atlas knowing what she wanted without her even having to say it. Except, of course, for the one thing he could never know.
"Yes,"
Avery said, a little too quickly. He nodded.
"Let's go, then."
They walked out onto Cord's doorstep and took the hover that Atlas had called. Avery leaned back on the seat and closed her eyes, letting the familiar hum of the magnetic propulsion system wash over her. She listened for the rise and fall of Atlas's breathing. He really was here, she kept telling herself. It wasn't just another one of her dreams. When they reached the 1,000th floor penthouse, Avery fell backward onto her bed, still in her dress. Everything was a little dizzy.
"You okay?"
Atlas asked, settling onto the corner of her enormous cream-colored comforter.
"Mm-hmm," she murmured.
She was better than she'd been in months, here, alone, with Atlas, in the semi-darkness. He scooted over a little. She closed her eyes. Right now, with him sitting on her bed, Avery could almost pretend he was just a boy she'd met and brought home, not someone her parents adopted when she was 5 years old because she was lonely and they didn't have time for her.
"Remember when you first came here?" she asked.
She'd been sitting on the playroom floor brushing her doll's hair, and the front door had opened to reveal her mom, holding the hand of a hopeful, lost-looking boy.
"This is Atlas,"
her mom had said, and the boy had given a tentative smile. From that moment on, Avery adored him.
"Of course I remember," Atlas teased. "You demanded that I go straight to the park with you and drag you along on your hoverboard so you could pretend it was a pirate ship."
"I did not!"
Avery propped herself up on her elbows to glare at him in mock anger.
"It's okay. I didn't mind," he said softly.
Avery leaned back on her pillows. How strange that there had ever been a time in her life before Atlas.
It didn't seem possible anymore.
Aves? She heard Atlas say. If there was something I needed to know, you would tell me, right?
She opened her eyes and looked at his face, so clear and guileless. He wasn't suggesting the truth, was he? He couldn't be. He didn't know what it was like, wanting something you could never have, how impossible it was to unwant it once you'd let the feeling in.
I'm glad you're back.
I missed you, she told him.
Me too.
The silence stretched between them. Avery fought to stay awake, to drink in Atlas's presence, but sleep was dragging her down. After a moment, he stood and walked to the hallway.
I love you, he said, and pulled the door quietly shut behind him.
I love you too, her heart whispered, curling around the phrase like a prayer. Eris.
I'm heading home, Eris flickered Cord, not bothering to wait for his response.
His apartment was emptying as the party began to slowly disintegrate, people stumbling home alone or in pairs. Everywhere she looked, Eris saw the debris of an epic night, scattered cups and lost costume pieces and broken halluciliters. She hadn't meant to stay this long. She'd been flitting from group to group and lost all sense of time. She wasn't sure where Cord was, and she felt too exhausted suddenly to go looking for him. All she wanted was a clean steam shower and her 1,000 thread count sheets. Eris started toward the door, scrolling idly through her messages, and realized with a start that she had several missed pings from home. They were timestamped from a couple of hours ago. She'd been on the dance floor. She remembered tossing her head back and forth, ignoring them, but she hadn't registered at the time that they were from her parents. She wondered what was going on. When she reached her apartment on 985, Eris opened the door as slowly as she could, her black shoes in one hand and her clutch in the other. She knew the moment she stepped inside that something was wrong. The lights were on their brightest setting, and an awful, strangled sound came from the living room. Oh, God. It was her mom crying. Eris dropped her shoes on the floor with a loud clatter.
Eris?
Caroline lifted her head from where she lay curled on the couch. She was still wearing her evening gown, a beautiful scarlet question mark against the white cushions. Eris ran forward to throw her arms around her mom, pulling her close. She thought suddenly of when she was little and her parents would come home from parties. Eris would hear her mom's heels clacking in the hallway, a sound she'd always found strangely reassuring. And no matter how late it was, Caroline had always come to brush Eris's hair and tell her about all the wonderful, magical, grown-up things she'd seen that night. How many times had Eris fallen asleep listening to the sound of her mom's voice?
It's okay, Eris said softly, though clearly it wasn't.
Her eyes darted nervously around the apartment. Where was her dad?
No, it's not okay.
Caroline took a deep breath and pulled back to look Eris squarely in the eye. Mascara-filled tears etched black rivers down her face.
I'm so sorry.
What happened? Eris scooted back from her mom to sit upright, the movement brusquer than she'd intended. Where's Dad?
He left.
Caroline looked down, studying the hands clasped tight in her lap, the crumpled folds of her magnificent crimson dress.
What do you mean he left?
Remember that DNA test you took today? Eris nodded impatiently. Of course she remembered. She'd taken countless tests, given a cheek swab and peed on a stick, and signed so many old-fashioned paper documents with a real ink pen that her hand had cramped with the unfamiliar movement. Wordlessly, Eris's mom tapped the coffee table, which, like all the surfaces in their apartment, had touchscreen capabilities. A few quick swipes and she'd pulled an attachment from her message queue. Eris leaned forward to look. Her DNA was mapped there in all its glory, its strands an unrealistic bubblegum pink. But Eris's eyes were already skimming past that, to the jumble of medical words and bar charts below. She knew they'd run her DNA against her dad's,
which was already on file, yet she couldn't process what she was seeing now. What did it all have to do with her? Her eyes caught on a single line at the bottom. Percentage match, 0.00%. And she reached out a hand to steady herself. An ugly, sticky realization was closing around her throat. I don't believe this. She sat up straighter, her voice gaining volume. The lab messed up the sequencing. We need to ping them back, get them to redo it. They did redo it. It's not wrong. It seemed as if her mom was talking from very far away, as if Eris were underwater or buried under a mountain of sand. No, Eris repeated blindly. It's true, Eris. The finality in Caroline's tone made Eris cold all over, and then she understood why her DNA wasn't a match, why her mom wasn't acting more surprised. Because Eris wasn't her father's daughter after all. Her mom had cheated on her dad and kept it a secret for the past 18 years. Eris shut her eyes. This wasn't happening. It couldn't be. If she kept her eyes closed, it would go away, like a bad dream. Her mom reached out a hand and Eris shot to her feet, knocking over the coffee table as she did. Neither of them looked at it. They just stared at each other, mother and daughter, so painfully alike. And yet to Eris, they had never felt more like strangers. Why? She asked, because it was the only word her mind could process. Why did you lie to me all those years? Oh, Eris, I didn't mean... It wasn't about you. Are you serious? Of course it's about me! Caroline winced. That's not what I meant. It's just... Whatever happens between me and Everett, it's not your fault. I know, because it's your fault! Neither of them spoke. The silence scraped at Eris's eardrums. Where did Dad go? When is he coming back? She asked finally. I'm not sure. Her mom sighed. I'm sorry, Eris. Stop saying that! By now, Eris was screaming. She couldn't help it. She didn't want to hear another apology from her mom. Apologies meant nothing when the person you trusted the most had been lying to you your whole life. Her mom was utterly still. I know this is really hard on you, and you must have a lot of questions. I'm here to answer. Fuck you and your fucking explanations, Eris interrupted, enunciating each word. Her mom drew back in wounded shock, but Eris ignored it. Her mind was shuffling through all her memories of her mom, of when Caroline would come wake her up for elementary school, only to snuggle into Eris's bed with her and fall back asleep. Forcing Eris's dad to come wake them both up, laughing about what sleeping beauties his girls were. Of the Christmases they had baked cookies to put under the tree for Santa, made almost entirely from raw dough, and then Dad would go eat them in the middle of the night even long after Eris knew Santa wasn't real. Of every year before her birthday, when Caroline would make up a fake doctor's appointment and pull Eris out of school to go shopping so they could pick out her presents and then go to Bergdorf's for tea. Your mom is so cool, the other girls always said, because none of their moms ever let them out of school just for fun, and Eris would laugh and say, Yeah, I know, she's the best. It all felt fake now. Every gesture, every I love you, all of it was tinted by the great ugly lie underpinning her life. Eris blinked in confusion at her mom's familiar face. So you've known my entire life. She said bitterly. No, I wasn't sure. Her mom's eyes brimmed with unshed tears, but she managed to hold them back. I always thought, hoped, that you were Everett's. But I never knew for certain until now. Why the hell did you let me take that DNA test, then? You think if I knew there was a test, I would have let you go? Her mom cried out. Eris didn't know what to say. She didn't understand how her mom could have done this to her, to her dad, to their family. Please, Eris, I want to make this right, Caroline began, but Eris shook her head. Don't talk to me, she said slowly and turned away. Somehow Era stumbled to her round bed, nestled to one side of her enormous circular room. Shock and fear were swirling dangerously in her chest. She couldn't breathe. She clawed suddenly at the neck of her shirt, still damp with her mom's tears, and yanked it brutally over her head, then took a desperate, ragged breath. She was pretty sure she'd heard one of the seams rip out. "Can I be of assistance?" her contacts prompted, sensing that she was almost crying. "Shut up," she muttered, and they obediently powered down. Everett Radson wasn't her father. The truth of it kept ricocheting painfully against her skull like gunfire. Her poor dad. She wondered what he'd said when he got the lab results. Where was he now? A hotel? The hospital? She wanted to go talk to him, yet at the same time she wasn't quite ready to face him. She knew that when she saw him, when she truly came face to face with it all, that everything would be different, for good. Eris closed her eyes, but the world kept spinning around her. She wasn't even drunk tonight. This must be the feeling, she thought bitterly, of her life coming untethered. She sat up and studied her room with an odd sense of detachment. Everywhere she looked were expensive things. The crystal vase with its ever-young roses, the closet filled with delicate, colorful dresses, the custom-made vanity cluttered with gleaming pieces of tech. All the trappings of her life, everything that made her Eris Dodd Radson. She started to lean back onto her pillows and cursed aloud as something sharp dug into her ear. Her mom's earrings. She'd forgotten all about them. Eris unscrewed the right earring and held it out on her palm. It was so beautiful, a glass sphere glowing with whorls of color, like the eye of a coming storm. A beautiful, rare, expensive present from her dad to her mom. Suddenly, the earring and everything it stood for struck Eris as unbearably false. She pulled back her arm and hurled the earring against the wall with all the strength she had. It exploded into a million pieces, which scattered over the floor like shards of glittering tears. Rylan. As the last guest stumbled from Cord's party into a waiting hover, Rylan heaved a sigh of relief. The night had felt endless, cleaning up all those drunk kids' messes, pretending not to notice how some of the guys looked at her. She was exhausted, and her head still pounded from being yanked out of the communal. But thank God she was finally done. Stretching her arms overhead, she wandered to the windows in Cord's living room and gazed hungrily at the horizon line in the distance. The view screens in her apartment were so old that they didn't even look like windows anymore, more like garish cartoons of a fake view, with a too bright sun and overly green trees. There was a window along the side of her monorail stop at work. Ryland's snack stand was at the Crane Boulevard stop, between Manhattan and Jersey. But even that was too close to see anything except the tower, squatting like a giant steel toad that blocked out the sky. Impulsively, she pressed her face to the glass. It felt blissfully cool on her aching forehead. Finally, Rylan peeled herself away and started upstairs to check in with Cord and get the hell out of there. As she walked, the lights behind her turned off and the ones ahead of her clicked on, illuminating a hallway lined with antique paintings. She passed an enormous bathroom, filled with plush hand towels and touchscreens on every surface. Hell, the floor was probably even a touchscreen. Rylan was willing to bet that it could read your weight or heat up on voice command. Everything here was the best, the newest, the most expensive. Everywhere she looked, she saw money. She walked a little faster. When she reached the holoden, Rylan hesitated. Projected on the wall wasn't the action immersion or dumb comedy she had expected. It was old family vids.
"Oh, no, don't you dare!"
Cord's mom exclaimed in vibrant 3D. A 4-year-old Cord grinned, holding a garden hose. Where was this? Rylan wondered. On vacation somewhere?
"Oops!"
he proclaimed, without an ounce of contrition, as he turned the hose on his mom. She laughed, throwing up her tanned arms,
her dark hair streaming with water like a mermaid's. Rylan had forgotten how pretty she was. Cord leaned forward eagerly, sitting almost on the edge of his leather armchair. A smile played on his lips as he watched his dad chase his younger self around the yard. Rylan retreated a step. She would just... The floor creaked under her feet, and Cord's head shot up. Instantly, the vid cut off.
I'm sorry, she stammered. I just wanted to let you know I'm finished, so I'm heading out.
Cord's eyes traveled slowly over her outfit, her tight jeans and low-cut shirt, and the tangle of neon bracelets at her wrists.
I didn't have time to go home and change, she added, not sure why she was explaining herself to him.
You didn't give me much notice. Cord just stared at her, saying nothing. Rylan realized with a start that he hadn't recognized her. Then again, why should he? They hadn't seen each other in years, since that Christmas his parents had invited her family over for presents and cookies. Rylan remembered how magical it had seemed to her and Krissa, playing in the snow in the enclosed greenhouse, like a real-life version of the snow globe toy her mom always got out for the holidays. Cord had spent the whole time in some hollow game, oblivious.
Rylan Myers,
Cord said at last, as if she had stumbled into his party by chance rather than been paid to work it.
How the hell are you?
He gestured to the seat next to him, and Rylan surprised herself by sinking into it, pulling her legs up to sit cross-legged.
Aside from being groped by your friends, just great, she said without thinking.
Sorry, she added quickly. It's been a long night. She wondered where Hyrule and the gang were, if they'd finally noticed her disappearance.
Well, most of them aren't my friends, Cord said matter-of-factly.
He shifted his weight, and Rylan couldn't help noticing the way his shoulders rippled under his button-down shirt. She sensed suddenly that his carelessness was deceptive, that beneath it all he was watching her intently. For a moment they both stared at the dark screen. It was funny, Rylan thought. If you told her earlier that her night would end here, hanging out with Cord Anderton, she would have laughed.
What is that?
Cord asked, and Rylan realized she was playing with her necklace again. She dropped her hands to her lap.
It was my mom's, she said shortly, hoping that would end it. She'd given the necklace to her mom as a birthday present one year, and after that her mom never took it off.
Rylan remembered the pang she'd felt when the hospital sent it back to her, folded in plastiwrap and labeled with a cheerful orange tag. Her mom's death hadn't felt real until that moment.
Why the Eiffel Tower?
Cord pressed, sounding interested.
Why the hell do you care?
Rylan wanted to snap back, but caught herself. It was an inside joke of ours, she said simply. We used to always say that if we ever had the money, we would take the train to Paris, eat at a fancy Café Paris. She didn't bother explaining how she and Krissa used to turn their kitchen into a snooty French café. They would make paper berets and draw mustaches on their faces with their mom's paint stick, and adopt terrible French accents as they served her the chef's special, whatever frozen food packet had been on sale that week. It always made their mom smile after a long day's work.
Did you ever end up going? Cord asked.
Rylan almost laughed at the stupidity of the question.
I've barely left the tower.
The room sounded with sudden shouting and water spraying as the screen lit back up with the holovid. Cord quickly shut it off. His parents had died years ago, Rylan remembered, in a commercial airline crash.
It's nice that you have those vids, she said into the silence.
She understood why he would be possessive about them. She would have done the same if she and Krissa had any.
I wish we had more of my mom.
I'm sorry, Cord said quietly.
It's fine,
she shrugged, though of course it wasn't fine. It wouldn't be fine ever again. The tension was broken by a sudden rumble sounding in the room. It took Rylan a moment to realize that it had come from her own stomach. Cord looked at her curiously.
You hungry?
He asked, though the answer was obvious.
We could break out the leftovers if you want. Yes, Ryland said, more enthusiastically than she'd meant to. She hadn't eaten since lunch.
Next time you should eat the catering, Cord said as they started out of the hollow den and down the sweeping glass staircase. Guess I should have told you that.
Ryland wondered what made him think there would be a next time. When they reached the kitchen, the fridge cheerfully informed Cord that he'd consumed 4,000 calories so far today, 40% of which were from alcohol. And per his muscle regime 2118, he was allowed nothing else. A glass of water materialized in the fridge's export slot.
Muscle regime. I should get one of those, Ryland deadpanned.
I'm trying to be healthy.
Cord turned back to the machine.
Guest override, please,
he mumbled, then looked at Ryland, redder than she'd ever seen him.
Could you just put your hand on the fridge to prove you're here?
Ryland placed her palm on the refrigerator, which dutifully swung open. Cord began pulling out containers at random, pumpkin seed milk bars and 100-layer lasagna and fresh apple berries. Ryland grabbed a box of pizza cones out of his hand and tore into one. It was cheesy and fried and perfect, maybe even better cold. When Cord handed her a napkin, she realized that sauce had dripped onto her chin, but somehow she didn't care. As he leaned back against the counter, Ryland caught sight of something over his shoulder and let out a squeal.
Oh my God, are those gummy buddies? Do they actually move when you bite off their heads like they do in the adverts?
You've never had a gummy buddy?
No.
A bag of gummy buddies cost more than what she and Krissa spent on food in a week. They were the first edible electronics, with microscopic radio frequency ID tags inside each candy.
Come on.
Cord tossed her the bag.
Try one.
Ryland pulled out a bright green gummy and popped it whole into her mouth. She chewed expectantly, then glowered at him when nothing happened.
You didn't do it right.
Cord seemed to be struggling to keep his face straight.
You have to bite off the head or the legs. You can't just eat it all at once.
She grabbed another gummy and bit off the bottom half. The RFID chip in the remaining top part of the gummy abruptly let out a high-pitched scream.
Crap!
Ryland yelled, dropping the gummy head on the floor. It kept twitching near her feet, and she took a step back. Cord laughed and grabbed the rest of the gummy, tossing it into the trash, which suctioned it off to the sorting center.
Here, try again, he said, holding out the bag. If you bite off the head, they don't scream, just move around.
I'm good, thanks.
Ryland tucked a strand of hair behind one ear and glanced back up at Cord. Something about the way he was looking at her made her fall silent. Then he was closing the distance between them, and lowering his mouth to hers. At first, Ryland was too startled to react. Cord kissed her slowly, almost languidly, pressing her back against the counter. The edge of it dug sharply into Ryland's hip, jarring her back to reality. She put both hands on his chest and pushed, hard. She crossed her arms as Cord stumbled backward, his breath ragged, his eyes dancing with amusement. A smile curled at the corners of his lips. Something about that look made Ryland shake with anger. She was furious with Cord for laughing at the situation, with herself for letting it unfold, and deep down, for enjoying it for a single, bewildered instant. Without stopping to think, she raised her arm and slapped him. The noise cracked through the air like a whip.
"I'm sorry," Cord finally said into the painful stillness. I obviously misread the situation.
Ryland watched the red mark of her hand blossoming on his face. She'd gone too far. He wouldn't pay her for tonight, and all that hard work would have been for nothing.
I should get going.
She was halfway out the front door when she heard footsteps in the entryway.
Hey, Myers!
Cord called out from behind her.
Catch!
She turned and caught the bag of gummy buddies in midair.
Thanks, she said, confused, but the door was already closing behind him.
Ryland leaned against the door of Cord's apartment and closed her eyes,
trying to gather the frayed and tangled strands of her thoughts. Her mouth felt bruised, almost seared. She could still feel where Cord had held her tight around the waist. With an angry sigh, she hurried down the 3 brick stairs that led to his entrance and started down the carbon-paved streets. The entire 2.5 miles home, Ryland pulled the heads off the gummy buddies one by one, letting their small screams fill the empty elevator car.
What?
What?
A tiny pink form barreled down the hallway as he walked inside the next day.
Hey, Zara!
Watt laughed, scooping his 5-year-old sister into his arms. Her dark curls had something sticky in them, and a costume tiara was perched precariously atop her head. Watt noticed that her pajama pants, which used to drag along the ground, now barely hit mid-calf. He made a mental note to buy her a new set the next time he was paid. Zara giggled, then wriggled impatiently out of his arms to run back into the living room, where her twin brother, Amir, was building something out of plastifoam blocks.
Watson, is that you?
Watt's mom called from the kitchen.
Yeah, Mom?
It was never a good sign when she used his full name.
You might want to change first, Nadia suggested, but Watt was already at the doorway.
Shirin hovered over the cook surface, pouring water into an instant noodle dinner. Watt remembered back before the twins were born, when she used to cook elaborate Persian meals from scratch. Rich lamb stews and golden flatbreads and rice sprinkled with sumac. Then she'd unexpectedly gotten pregnant and stopped cooking altogether, claiming the smell of spices made her nauseous. But even after the twins were born, the home-cooked Persian meals never came back. There wasn't enough time anymore. Shirin pushed the cook dial to high heat and turned to Watt.
"You were at Derek's all day?"
she asked, with a glance at his rumpled clothes from last night. Watt reddened. Nadia said nothing, but he could practically feel her thinking, "I told you so."
"Yeah, I stayed at Derek's last night,"
Watt said to his mom, but she just stared at him blankly.
"Today was our last day of summer, and we wanted to try finishing this game."
He trailed off. It was true, though. He'd barely spent any time at Squid Ink Martini Girls last night. Nadia was right. She didn't have much to say, and he felt somehow foolish for having left the bar with her. He had ducked out almost immediately to head for Derek's. He'd spent the night there, and this morning they'd eaten enormous sandwiches from the bagel shop and watched soccer on the tiny screen in Derek's living room. It wasn't that Watt had been avoiding home, exactly, but Derek didn't have 2 younger siblings who needed constant attention. His parents basically let him do what he wanted, as long as he kept up his grades.
"I could have used your help today," Shirin went on, sounding more defeated than angry. "The twins had a checkup this afternoon. I had to get Tasha to fill in for me at the center so that I could take them, since I couldn't find you. I'll have to work double shifts the rest of the week just to make up the time."
Watt felt like utter crap.
"You could have pinged me,"
he said lamely, pretty sure he'd ignored a call at some point last night.
"You were too busy playing that hollow game,"
his mom snapped, then let out a sigh.
"It's fine. Just get your brother and sister."
She set bowls and spoons on the table as the door opened again, eliciting more excited squeals from Zara. Moments later, Watt's dad was in the kitchen, a twin on each hip. He usually had to work much later than this. Having him home for dinner was practically a special occasion.
"Dinner's ready, Rashid."
Watt's mom greeted him with a tired kiss on the cheek. They all crammed around the small table. Watt shoved the instant noodles and canned vegetables into his mouth without tasting them, not that they had much taste to begin with. He was angry with his mom for making him feel guilty. What was wrong with him occasionally blowing off steam at a mid-tower bar? Or spending the last day of summer hanging out with his friend? The moment Zara yawned, her hands making small fists over her head, Watt stood up as if on cue.
"The bedtime monorail is about to leave. All aboard," he announced in a too deep voice.
"Choo-choo!"
Zara and Amir attempted a train noise and trotted alongside Watt. The actual monorail was silent, of course, but the twins watched tons of animated train hollows and loved making that sound. Watt's dad smiled, watching them. Sheeran pursed her lips and said nothing. Watt led the twins down a winding imaginary train track to the end of the hall. Their room was tiny, but still bigger than his. This used to be Watt's room, actually, before they were born and he moved into the office nook. The dim light barely illuminated the bunk beds built into the wall. Watt had repeatedly tried to route more electricity to the twins, but it never seemed to be enough. He had a sinking suspicion that it was his fault, because of all the power-hungry hardware he'd set up in his room. He helped the twins laser clean their teeth and tucked them into bed. They didn't have a room comp down here, of course, but Nadia did the best vitals check she could, watching the twins' breathing and eye movement. When she'd confirmed they were asleep, Watt shut the door quietly and moved down the hallway to his makeshift bedroom. He sank gratefully into his ergonomic swivel chair, which he'd lifted from an office space that was about to be foreclosed, and clicked on the high-def screen at his desk, which took up most of the room. His bed was shoved far to the corner, his clothes tucked on hover beams up near the ceiling. Nadia didn't need the screen, of course, since she could project anything directly onto his contacts. But Watt still liked surfing the iNet this way whenever possible. Even he thought it was weird sometimes. Replacing your entire field of vision with the digital overlay. He flipped through all the messages from the girls he'd met at Pulse last night, then closed out without answering any of them. Instead, he logged into Hacker House, his favorite dark web site for postings of data services jobs. Watt's family always needed money. His parents had moved from Isfahan to New York the year before he was born, when the tower was new and the whole world was excited about it, before Shanghai and Hong Kong and Sao Paulo all got their own thousand-story megatowers. Watt knew his parents had immigrated for his sake, hoping he would have a chance at a better future. It hadn't turned out the way they'd hoped. Back in Iran, Watt's dad had attempted the top mechanical engineering school, and his mom had been studying as a doctor. But Rashid now worked repairing industrial coolant and sewage systems. Sheeran had been forced to get a job as a caregiver at a nursing home, just so they could keep their apartment. They never complained, but Watt knew it wasn't easy on them, working long days hammering machinery and dealing with crotchety old people, then coming downstairs to take care of the family. And no matter how hard they tried, money always seemed to be tight, especially now that the twins were getting older. Which was why Watt had started saving for college. Well, for MIT. Their microsystems engineering program was the best in the world, and Watt's best shot at someday working on one of the few legal quants left, the ones owned by the UN and NASA. He wasn't applying to any safety schools. His parents worried that his insistence was stubborn and overconfident, but Watt didn't care. He knew he would get in. The real question was how he would pay for it. He'd been applying to scholarships and had won a few small grants here and there, but nowhere near enough to pay for 4 years at an expensive private university. So Watt had started making money a different way, by venturing to the darker part of the iNet and answering ads for what were euphemistically called information services. In other words, hacking. Together, he and Nadia falsified employment records, changed students' grades at various school systems, even broke into Flickr accounts for people who thought their significant others were cheating. Only once did they try hacking a bank security system, and that ended almost immediately when Nadia detected a virus hurtling toward them and shut herself off. After that, Watt tried to steer clear of anything too illegal, except, of course, for the fact of Nadia's existence. But he took on jobs whenever he could, depositing most of the proceeds in a savings account and giving the rest to his parents. They knew he was good with technology. When he told them the money came from tech support jobs online, they didn't question it. He scrolled idly through the Hacker House requests, stifling a yawn. As usual, most were too absurd or too illegal for him to take on, but he flagged a few for later review. One in particular caught his eye, asking for information on a missing person. Those were usually easy jobs if the person was still in the country.
Nadia had long ago hacked the national security cam link and could use facial recognition to find people in a matter of minutes. Curious, Watt read further, an eyebrow raised. It certainly was an unusual request. The author of the post wanted information on someone who had been missing this past year, but who had since returned. "I need to know where he's been this whole time and why he came home," the person requested. Sounded easy enough. Watt immediately composed a reply, introducing himself as Nadia, the name he used for all his hacking jobs because, well, why not? And saying that he'd love to help. He leaned back, drumming his fingers on the armrests. "I might be interested," the person who'd written the post replied. "But I need proof you can actually do what you say you can do." Well, well, a newbie. Everyone who repeatedly posted on these forums knew enough about Watt to know he was a professional. He wondered who this person was. "Nadia, can you?" "Yes," Nadia answered, knowing his question before he even finished speaking, and hacking into the sender's security to find the hardware address. "Got her. Here she is." On the screen appeared the girl's feed profile. She was Watt's age, and lived right here in the tower, up on the 962nd floor. "What did you have in mind?" he answered, a little intrigued. "His name is Atlas Fuller. Tell me something I don't know about him, and the job is yours." Nadia found Atlas instantly. He was at home, on the 1,000th floor. Watt was stunned. This guy actually lived on the 1,000th floor? Not that Watt had given the tower's penthouse much thought, but if pressed, he wouldn't have guessed a teenager lived there. What an idiot, Watt thought, running away when that was your life. "Can we hack their home comp?" Watt asked Nadia, thinking maybe he could get a snap of Atlas in his bedroom. But Nadia wasn't having any luck. "It's an incredibly sophisticated system," she told Watt, which he knew meant that it could take weeks. Better to get something now. This job was too good to lose. His messages, then. That would be easier to hack. Sure enough, Nadia immediately pulled up Atlas's most recent messages. A few had been sent to guys named Ty and Maxton, and the rest to someone named Avery. None were that exciting. Watt sent them all over anyway. Moments later, the girl's reply came in. "Congratulations, you're hired. Now I need you to find as much as you can about what Atlas has been doing the past year." "As you wish," Watt couldn't help replying. "In addition," the girl went on, ignoring the sarcastic turn of phrase, "I'm offering a weekly payment in exchange for constant updates on him, what he's doing, where he's going, any information you can provide. This is all for his own safety," she concluded, in an incredibly unconvincing afterthought. "His safety, sure," Watt thought with a laugh. He knew a spurned lover post when he saw one. This had to be either Atlas's ex-girlfriend trying to win him back, or a current girlfriend worried about him cheating on her. Either way, the job was a freaking gold mine. Watt had never even seen a request for a hacker on retainer before. Most hacker house posts were one-time gigs, because most hacks were, by nature, one-and-dones. This girl wanted to send him weekly payments just to track her crush's movements? It was easy money, and he had no intention of messing it up. "Lita Cole?" Watt said aloud as he pushed send. "It's going to be a real pleasure doing business with you." Lita. "Good afternoon, Miss Cole," said Jeffrey, the doorman at Altitude Club, as Lita walked up to the elevator bank the next day. Altitude had biosecurity too, of course. Lita knew her retina had been scanned the moment she stepped into the entrance hall. But Jeffrey was the kind of personalized and old-fashioned touch that made Altitude membership so expensive. He was a constant fixture of the club, practically an institution himself by now. Always at the elevator wearing white gloves and a green jacket and a warm, crinkly smile. Jeffrey moved aside, and Lita walked into the enormous brass members-only elevator. The doors closed behind her with a satisfying click as she was whisked up from the 930th floor entrance hall,
past the tennis courts and spa treatment rooms to the club's main floor. The altitude lobby was lined with imposing dark mahogany and portraits of dead members. Afternoon sunlight streamed through the floor-to-ceiling windows that lined the north and west walls. Lita glanced at the various groups gathered near empty fireplaces and clusters of couches, trying to seem nonchalant as she searched for Atlas. If this so-called Nadia person was right, his squash game should be ending right about now. She still couldn't believe she'd posted on that sketchy website. It had been nerve-wracking and yet a little thrilling, too, doing something so clearly illegal and dangerous. She'd tried to upgrade her security first, but Lita still couldn't help wondering if Nadia knew more than he or she was letting on, about who Lita was and why she was curious about Atlas. Oh well, she thought. None of it really mattered. Nadia probably didn't live in the tower. Probably wasn't even a girl. And Lita had no intentions of dealing with her or him ever again once she'd gotten what she wanted. A moment later, she saw Atlas walking out of the locker room. He had on a soft blue polo that brought out the caramel-colored strands of his hair, still wet from the shower. Nice work, Nadia. Atlas, she said, with what she hoped was the right amount of surprise. What are you up to? Just finished a squash match with David York. He flashed her a smile. Sounds like it's all back to normal, then, Lita replied, a little more sarcastically than she'd meant to. She wondered what the Fullers thought about his reappearance, the way he'd just materialized inexplicably at Cord's party and jumped right back into their lives as if nothing had happened. Then again, they were the ones obsessed with maintaining appearances. This whole illusion of normalcy was probably their idea. About that, he sighed. I wish I could explain everything, but it's complicated. Isn't it always with you? I'm just glad you're back, okay? Me too, Atlas said softly, then glanced around the club as if noticing the flow of activity for the first time. Kids heading to afternoon tennis lessons and friends meeting up for drinks on the enclosed terrace. Sorry, were you waiting for someone? I was on my way to the juice bar, Lita lied. Want to come? You and Avery still drink that liquid spinach? Atlas laughed, shaking his head. I'll pass, thanks. Want to do the grill instead? I guess I have time, Lita said casually, though this was exactly the kind of thing she'd been hoping for. They headed across the lobby to Altitude's casual grill and grabbed a table near the back, next to the window. Even though she loved the view here, Lita took the seat that faced away from the plexiglass so she could look out over the restaurant. She liked keeping track of everyone coming and going. I haven't been here in ages, Lita admitted as they settled in. She thought suddenly of middle school, before her family had gotten into the club, when she always spent the night at Avery's and then came to Saturday brunch here with the Fullers. She and Avery would pile their plates with egg whites and lemon cakes and try to sneak sips from the mimosa fountain, while Atlas rolled his eyes at their antics and messaged his friends. Yeah, me neither, Atlas said, then laughed. Obviously. Drew, who'd been the waiter at the grill since Lita could remember, walked up to their table. Miss Cole! And Mr. Fuller! We're all so glad you're back. Glad to be back, Atlas smiled. Can I get you two something to drink? I'd love a beer, actually, Atlas said, and Drew winked. Atlas had recently turned 18, so he was legal, but Drew had been sneaking them drinks for years now. Iced tea would be great, thanks, Lita murmured. What, no whiskey cream? Atlas quipped as Drew walked away. You know that's an Andes-only drink. Lita tried to play it cool, but her heart was racing. What was he doing, referencing that? Thanks, by the way, for the other night, Atlas went on. Lita hesitated. About Avery, he clarified. You were right, she was really drunk. I ended up taking her home after that game of spinners. Oh, sure, Lita agreed, hiding her confusion. She'd just made that up in order to keep from playing spinners. She was surprised, actually, to learn that it had been true. Avery wasn't usually the girl who needed to be taken home. She hoped everything was okay.
anyway.
He grinned, and Lita felt that rush again of being the focus of Atlas's attention. It was a frighteningly addictive sensation.
I'm so out of the loop. Tell me everything I've missed this year.
She saw what he was doing, deflecting attention away from himself, from questions about where he'd been. Well, she could play along.
I'm sure you've heard about Eris and Cord, Lita began, taking a quick breath to steady herself.
She tried to mentally recite a meditation chant, but none came to mind.
Did you hear about Anandra, though?
The conversation meandered. Lita told him about Anandra Kemka's stealing spree, about Grace and Baxter's parents getting back together, about Avery and Zay, everything that had happened in the year he was away. Thankfully, Atlas didn't seem to notice that her stories were light on details about the past summer. He just listened and nodded, and even suggested that they share an order of nachos.
Sure, Lita agreed, trying not to read into it. But there was something intimate about eating off the same plate, the way their hands kept brushing as they reached for the same avocado-smothered quinoa chips. Was it her imagination, or was this feeling more and more like a date?
Drew finally came back over. The table's view screen projected the bill in front of them, the numbers a dark blue hollow on a white background.
"Do you want me to charge to your separate?"
he started. But Atlas was already waving his hand to put the whole charge on the Fuller's account.
"No way. It's my treat," Atlas said.
Maybe he was just being chivalrous, or maybe she was right, and this was turning into a date.
"What are your plans this week? Want to do something?" she ventured.
Time seemed to freeze, the way it used to right before an exam when she'd popped a Zemperhydrin. Atlas's hand lay there on the table between them. Lita couldn't think of anything but the way that hand had been tangled up in her hair, tipping her head back that night 10 months ago. She wondered if Atlas thought back on that night the way she did, if he wondered what could have happened between them if he hadn't left. She looked up and met his gaze. Her heart was pounding so hard she almost couldn't hear. He was about to say something. She leaned in.
Hey!
Avery pulled up a seat next to Lita and pulled a perfectly toned, tanned arm forward in a stretch.
Man, anti-grav yoga today was killer! How are you guys?
Hey, Avery. Lita smiled, hiding her disappointment at her best friend's timing. She couldn't believe she hadn't noticed her arrival. She'd been so focused on Atlas that she'd forgotten to watch the girl's entrance the way she usually did.
I missed you in class, Lita.
It wasn't a reproof, just a question. Avery's eyes flicked to Lita and Atlas, his empty beer mug and the remains of the nachos on the table between them. Lita shifted uncomfortably. She'd gotten so excited about Nadia's intel on Atlas that she'd forgotten to answer Avery's flicker from last night about hanging out today.
Oh, yeah, she said guiltily. I just came by for a juice. I've been totally lazy all day.
And then I talked Lita into nachos instead. Sorry we didn't leave you any.
Atlas gestured wryly at the empty plate.
No worries.
Avery's eyes were back to Lita.
Are you guys heading home? Want to share a hover?
Works for me. You ready to go?
Atlas said, turning to her.
Sure, Lita said, telling herself that she'd get more time with Atlas soon enough.
What Nadia had done once, she could easily do again. As they started back toward the club's entrance, Avery reached to pull Lita back.
Can we talk about last night?
Right. Sorry I left without telling you, Lita said, deliberately misunderstanding. I just got really tired all of a sudden, and I couldn't find you to say bye. You know how it is.
No, I meant about earlier. I didn't mean to push you about...
I told you, it's fine, Lita said, more curtly than she meant to. But seriously, couldn't Avery just take a hint?
Okay. If you want to talk about it, I'm here.
Thanks. Lita glanced warily at Avery and decided to turn the tables.
What about you? Atlas said you were really drunk at the end of the night, that he had to take you home?
First party back. Guess I got a little carried away.
There was something funny in Avery's tone, though Lita couldn't say exactly what.
I get it. That was a great party, she concurred, not sure why she was overcompensating.
Definitely. Avery wasn't even looking at Lita. It was great. They didn't say anything else until they caught up with Atlas near the entrance. Lita couldn't remember the last time she and Avery had been at a loss for words. Then again, I've never kept a secret from her before, Lita thought, just as Atlas turned back to smile at them both. And she realized, of course, that wasn't true at all. Her biggest secret was standing right there before her. She just hoped he wasn't also her biggest mistake.
Avery. So there I was, standing alone on a rainy cobblestone street, and I couldn't get any kind of signal because, you know, Florence is a tech-dark mess, and this group of Midtower kids comes up. Avery was telling the story on autopilot, talking without fully registering what she was saying, a skill she'd picked up from her mom. She couldn't shake the strange feeling that had settled over her when she saw Lita and Atlas together. It doesn't mean anything, she kept telling herself, but part of her knew that wasn't true. It meant something to Lita. When she'd first seen them across the grill, Avery had smiled and waved, only to lower her hand self-consciously. They were too absorbed in their conversation to notice her. For a brief instant, she wondered what they were talking about. And then she saw the look on Lita's face, and the realization hit her like a punch to the stomach. Lita liked Atlas. Why hadn't Lita ever told her? Because he's your brother, the rational part of her mind supplied. But Avery was too shocked and hurt to think rationally. There aren't supposed to be any secrets between me and Lita, she thought bitterly, momentarily forgetting that she was keeping the same secret. Not to mention Lita's defensive, overwrought reaction when Avery caught her in a lie about the summer. Why can't you just let it go? Lita had exclaimed. And Avery wanted to let it go, except Lita's reaction had worried her. She felt a sudden flash of anger. She'd been so concerned about her friend that she'd been planning to stop by Lita's on the way home from yoga, and the whole time Lita had been eating nachos and flirting with Atlas. When had she and Lita started hiding so much from each other?
Then what happened? Atlas prompted.
Avery turned in her seat to answer. She'd selfishly and strategically taken the hover's middle spot.
They offered to help me find my dorm, because I was wearing your old hockey sweatshirt, and they apparently played us last year. Can you believe it? Mile-high kids, all the way in Italy. What are the chances?
That's crazy, Lita said flatly, and Avery felt a burst of shame for the way she'd told the story. Mile-high was the term Uptower kids used for the suburban wasteland of the middle floors, since it was literally a mile above ground level. Lita had been a mile higher, once upon a time.
I just can't believe you were wearing that old sweatshirt abroad, Atlas teased.
Yeah, it looked ridiculous. Avery shrugged and fell silent, suddenly embarrassed that she'd snuck into Atlas's room and grabbed the sweatshirt. Even though he'd been gone for months by then, it had still smelled like him. The hover turned out of the vertical corridor onto floor 962, toward Treadwell, the gated luxury community where the Coles lived.
"Hey, Avery," Lita began. The hover pulled up to the gate and she leaned out, letting the scanner review her retina and confirm that she was a resident. "Are you doing anti-grav yoga again tomorrow? Want to go together?"
"Maybe." Avery shrugged noncommittally. "I'm kind of sore from today." The hover turned onto Treadwell's wide, tree-lined boulevard, which felt even bigger thanks to the elevated ceiling that stretched five stories overhead. Treadwell was modeled after the old Upper East Side brownstones. Some of its homes had actually been salvaged from the old neighborhood, then reconstructed stone by stone inside the tower. Avery liked it down here, the way the buildings all felt unique, with their own scrolling ironwork and their own facades. Each structure caught the afternoon light in a different way. It reminded her of Istanbul, or Florence, anywhere that people still injected personality into their homes, a far cry from most neighborhoods uptower, where the streets were lined with bright white doors like fat, frosted slices of wedding cake. Finally, they pulled up to the Coles. Lita pressed a button overhead, releasing the safety magnetron that held her in her seat.
Well, see you soon.
Her gaze turned to Atlas and her smile softened.